Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 302, I have the distinct honor and pleasure of being joined by my colleague and one of my mentors, Dr. William Smitty. Dr. Smitty is a professor of ophthalmology here at the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute, but more than that, he is a retina legend. He is one of the most prominent vitreoretinal surgeons of his era, an extensively published researcher, editor, and reviewer, and truly, again, one of my mentors and one of the people who inspired me to pursue the field of retina. So I'm really excited for this opportunity to sit down with Dr. Smitty. Remember, you can find lists of financial disclosures for participants and a link to claim CME credits for this podcast and many other podcast episodes. That's all in the episode description, and I hope you enjoy this interview. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. William Smitty. Dr. Smitty is professor of ophthalmology in the M. Bren Green Chair in Ophthalmology at the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute. And thank you again for joining us, Dr. Smitty.
Thank you for having me.
So, new guest on the program. We ask all new guests the same question. I actually don't know the answer for you. I don't think you've ever told me. So why did you decide to become an ophthalmologist and then a retina specialist? Was this, some people go into medical school and that's the reason they went to medical school. They already kind of knew what they wanted to do. And then some of us discovered along the way and we had other plans. So like when you decided to become a doctor, what was your initial vision of what you're going to be doing with your life?
Well, that's kind of an interesting story. I guess everyone's got their story, but my mom was a nurse and she was a mental health facility nurse for the state of Delaware. And there was a facility in where I grew up and went to, grade school. And she had a facility that she would go visit down in downstate Delaware. It so happened that Dr. Walter Stark, who is a cornea specialist at Johns Hopkins University, where I was going to college, I guess by that time, had would go over there every so often and give some gratis care to some of the inpatients there. And he had mentioned, oh, he's always looking for good people to do research, et cetera, et cetera. So my mom put me in touch with him and I did some cornea research, was how I really first got interested in ophthalmology. And I was interested in ophthalmology. I thought I'd be a cornea specialist eventually, because that's, Walter Stark, I really enjoyed watching him operate one day a week. I spent a summer or whatever it was. And then one of the features of the program I went to in medical school, early medical school, was this so-called tutorial project. So I, sucked up on whatever kind of work I could get through ophthalmology. So I ended up spending, I think it turned out to be like a day a week for a semester, something like that, with Stuart Fine in medical retina. He was at the time really conducting the macular photocoagulation study, just for historical perspective, that was resulted somewhere around 1984. Right around that time. But so I was just pretty interested in medical retina at that point. And then I can remember I was on call first year residency at one point, and I had to assist, the chief resident sometimes, or maybe I had the opportunity at that point. But whatever I can do is I can remember the first time I saw a retina case through like endo illumination. I said, wow, this is unbelievable. This is what I want to do. And the funny thing is, it was a patient that had some trauma and there was like blood all over the retinal surface. And I remember Paul Sternberg at the time was my chief resident. And I said, oh, that's really unbelievably beautiful. And he looks off the microscope and he says, this looks terrible. Look, how can you say that? But it's just the whole concept of seeing inside the eye, like as if you're walking on the moon or something, was so exciting to me. And then every step of the way, I just became more and more interested. Not only, of course, ophthalmology I was sold in really from early in medical school, and then retina not long after that. And so I ended up being very inbred, stayed at Johns Hopkins at Willmar for my residency fellowship. I was the chief resident. And then I've stayed, inbred, having been now at Bascom-Palmer since 1989, as soon as I had finished my chief residency.
It's funny you talk about that moment, because I think we all experience that moment at some point in our lives, and then you don't get jaded, but you get desensitized to it a little bit over time, right? You look at the retina every single day and you look at photos and you look at the retina in the OR, And I'm not saying that that sense of wonder dissipates completely, but it's not the same as the first or second time someone sees it. And that story just brings to mind, I remember when I was a resident, Oksana Rachetskaya, who was one of the chiefs here, was the chief at the time. And we had a medical student who's gone on and has done really well in a career as an ophthalmologist now. And I remember it was a bloody kind of tractional retinal detachment, very juicy. And the medical student just kept saying, "Oh my God, I can see the optic nerve. Oh, there's the optic nerve. Oh, where's the optic nerve?" And I remember, you know, Oksandra, bless her heart, at some point was talking to me. And she's like, you know, she's gonna talk like this the whole case. And I think we have to have a little bit of patience to forgive, because it is a really cool feeling the first time you see it. And it is easy sometimes to lose sight of that with all the other things we have to deal with, our jobs and everything on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I guess you could probably say that about a lot of professions.
True. So at Hopkins, you know, let's rewind before we get to Bascom. You know, at Hopkins, you obviously worked with Ron Michaels, and I think you quote him a lot. Julia Haller, who's my attending and fellowship, she used to quote him a lot, and he's had a huge influence. Obviously, the Ron Michaels Fellowship for Expanding Vitreoretinal Fellows is how many retina specialists know the name. But there was a lot more than that there in terms of education and teaching. So what was that experience like? And what are kind of the biggest Michaels sort of principles that you carry forward? Like, we always talk about, you hear your attendings' voices post-fellowship still in your head. And what are the things Ron Michaels would still say in your head after you left fellowship?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. Ron, I got to know very closely. You know, in those days, we didn't have an army of fellows distributed around a rotating agenda of attendings. So I would basically, you know, eat, drink, and not sleep, but I would just work with him full time for a 10-week rotation. And then I'd flip flop with Bert Glazer and then back with him. So, and I became, as a second year resident is when we really started doing that rotation as an observation fellow, really. It was retinal detachment rotation in your second year, and the third year was a vitrectomy rotation. So I was just purely observational. The idea was really, I think, a carryover from the real olden days of Harold Pierce and Bob Welsh, who did scleral buccals. So I felt kind of like I could get into his head and understand more than just sort of regurgitating some quotes that he'd say, you know? And I remember a lot of little things he'd say now that you're bringing it up. And, you know, for perspective, Julia was a couple of years my senior. So in our training program, the third year resident really works probably closest with the first year resident. And then the chief resident worked closest with the third year resident. So that's why I was fairly close to Julia. But Julia, if she ever had a chance to listen, will really laugh, because she would tell me this story one time. And I don't know that this is really answering your question, but in those days it was 20 gauge vitrectomy. So we had to close the sclerotomies with a vicryl suture, and there was ways of doing it, and et cetera, et cetera. But so a lot of times Ron was, you know, to some degree, it's kind of my training. He was very much an observational person. So you would watch what he would do, and he'd let you close the wounds at that time at the end. So Julia was telling the story how she was closing, and Ron peeked back in and said, "Julia, that is the worst sclerotomy closure I have ever seen in my life." And she felt so bad about that. She then went to Serge DeBustros, who's now in practice outside of Chicago. And he had been a fellow with Ron, I don't know, a couple of years before that. So she was telling Ron, she was telling Serge that, and kind of trying to look for some sympathy. And he says, "Oh, that's funny. That's what Ron used to tell me." So Ron was just the kind of guy that would always kind of keep you off balance a little bit. And he kind of would have a pretty strong bark, but, you know, once you got to know him, it was kind of a tough love kind of situation where he would, you know, he would tell you if something was bad or if something was wrong. It wasn't this, if I get in trouble saying this here in your podcast, it wasn't this kind of snowflake generation where, "Oh, everything's beautiful, everything's wonderful. And if that's what you think is a good closure of a sclerotomy, then I think it is too." You know, it's like, well, this is the way we do it. And he was very definitive about this is the step, and very focused. So I think sometimes I think I can personally almost even make it so patients don't think I'm caring about what they're talking about. He would go from step A to step B to step C to step D, whether it's the OR or the clinic. And he was, I think, really good with just keeping things moving. You know, it wasn't a Mr. Rogers sit down and let's have a 2-hour chat about this. It was, well, this is the situation. And not that he wouldn't allow a patient a chance to ask a question as much as he would just really direct them in a, you know, fairly like dog on a leash way, you know,
right.
it just wasn't a free flowing kind of interchange. So, again, I think I got off your question a little bit, but, you know, there's just a lot of times where there'd be things that you do and you just kind of go into a default of, well, this is what he would do. I mean, again, in the olden days, you know, okay, we'll put on a 287 tire and we'll do three rows of cryo for 360. Well, we'd never do that anymore, but that's the way you used to do broad treatment when you couldn't find a break or there was multiple breaks and you weren't sure you were finding all of them. And I remember one little saying he would always say, because he didn't like to just dilly-dally, you know, it'd be moving like the wind, he'd say, you know, so like the idea is, you know, just keep making forward progress. He'd even go right down to showing that when you're using the cutter in the eye, he says, you know, just always immerse that cutting port in vitreous. You know, there's no, doesn't do any good to have it just clicking around out there in liquefied vitreous or, you know, balanced salt. You want to always be making progress, you know, those are the things that really, you know, stick right out to me right now. But it's more of understanding a full philosophy from having felt, you know, truly mentored by him.
Right.
And, you know, actually in the earlier days of Baskin Palmer, we similar situation fellows where we really worked with them directly for extended periods of time where, you know, it's not only philosophy of medicine, but even just a degree of philosophy of life that you got opportunity to impart and get to know that person. And then I kind of feel like that's truly training because then you'd know how to react in any given circumstance because it's like you'd seen it over and over again. You had the principles down and you just knew what to do. So.
So, I mean, going back to that concept of default, I think that it's interesting. We always build on the shoulders of our predecessors, but it's always interesting how we take certain things for granted generationally. And I think if you walked into any, you know, well-read vitreoretinal surgical fellow and said, hey, so you have a macular hole that's full thickness and medium to large, you know, what would be kind of your surgical approach? And I think most would properly answer, you do a vitrectomy and you make sure the hyaloid's up and you peel the internal limiting membrane, you put some sort of gas tamponade, and then you can get in the weeds talking about positioning or not. But that wasn't always like just taken as truth. And if you go back, and it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on, if you go through the literature on why macular holes form or what's theorized about them and why ILM peeling works and why we do all the things we do, there was an evolution to this. It wasn't just one day people started doing this and it's stepwise over time. And now it's added up to kind of the dogma. This is how we treat this condition because this is a very successful way to treat it. So you were there and you wrote some papers, you know, on this subject, you know, as you're going through your career. I mean, just walk us back through that and then kind of give us your thoughts. So why do macular holes, do we know better in 2021 why macular holes form and how they close than we did 20 years ago?
Well, I think we do to some degree, but I don't want to say that we've monopolized the truth on that whole situation.
Right.
Always exceptions. And, you know, statistics is applied a lot, even to medicine, you know, biostatistics, they'll even call it. So just because there are exceptional cases doesn't mean that the general principles are violated as much as it's just that that's what general medicine is about. But in terms of going back historically, and I guess you know you're old when you start getting asked about history as opposed to what we're doing now.
We are a history buff, so we're going to talk more about history. So
yeah. That'd be good. But you know, macular holes. Nobody ever had any concept that you could, you know, look at the problem of macular hole and that was tackled. I think you must have heard the story that macular hole surgery was really discovered by accident. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the late '80s, early '90s. You know, Ron was really the one, I think, that had the concept of, and of course, this was well before the kind of imaging studies with OCT and the like that we have, was the concept that, well, is there an impending macular hole? So I think they're identifying a number of different cases where what we might now possibly consider to be on the spectrum of vitreomacular traction is the vitreous pulling right there at the central macula, and therefore, is this almost going to be a macular hole? And if it is, can you go in there and peel off that posterior hyaloid and prevent that? And so I think a lot of those kinds, and you know, using the silicone tip needle, or actually he wouldn't even use the silicone tip. He was at the time using the blood pool aspirator, which had the rigid tapered tip, to try to identify and visualize the posterior hyaloid lifting it off the retinal surface. And you know, a lot of the times the patients did not develop a macular holes. Occasionally they did, but in retrospect, we wonder, you know, whether that was really working or not. And there was an impending macular hole surgery. It was underpowered, but didn't show anything. But because what happened in the meanwhile was this story that you must be familiar with, that evidently Neil Kelly was treating a patient with a macular hole associated retinal detachment, which is more common in a high myope. And at the time, the standard treatment was to at least lightly laser around the edge of the macular hole once you had drained through the macular hole to flatten the retina under air. And he realized at the end of the case, after he closed up, that to his horror, he forgot to laser around the edges of the macular hole. But to his delight, as the bubble went away, the hole closed. Not only did the retina stay attached, but the hole closed. So then he was the one, somewhere again in the late 80s, I think, that therefore tested that hypothesis. Well, if I did this by mistake, could I do it on purpose? Mm-hmm. And he started treating macular holes. And I'd give a very positive shout out to him and Rob Wendell, his earliest partner. Well, I don't know if it's his earliest partner, but it was partner in developing macular hole surgery. They had, I think, luck of the draw, 9 out of 10, their first 10 cases or something closed. But they didn't publish that in a hurry. They didn't present that quickly at American Academy of Ophthalmology, but they put in an abstract, and then they did like 10 more. And I think of those 10, about only 4 of them closed, or some lower percentage. So when they actually presented it, they were honest enough to show it wasn't always being on your chest workout great. They said, well, look, this was like, I think 56% or whatever it was, 10 out of 19 or some number like that actually closed. So that's really what kind of kicked the ball going. So as you were saying, it's like these things evolve, but I think they go a little bit in fits and starts. So that was sort of the beginning start, as it were, that got people thinking. And what I do remember is when the first couple of cases that Neil Kelly did, he evidently presented that at the Aspen Retinal Detachment Society. And Bob Murphy happened to have been in attendance. And again, the way it used to work at Wilmer is that we'd listen to, we call it Monday morning conference. And if somebody was just coming back from a meeting, they'd have a faculty member typically stand up and say, well, this is what happened at the meeting, just to kind of debrief for the benefit of whoever was in attendance. So at the time, Ron would operate on Monday, Wednesday, and a lot of times Friday, but he'd want the second year resident, that was me then, to stay, to go and watch what we would now call grand rounds, the Monday morning conference. And so he says, oh, we go up there, and then he'd ask us, because he was always asking questions, wanting to learn things himself. And he'd say, well, what did you learn? And so, well, I explained how Bob Murphy said that Neil Kelly had presented this thing about a macular hole closing. And I remember Ron saying, oh, that's ridiculous. You can't make a macular hole disappear. So, I mean, just to show that as much as I would idolize, dare I say, Ron, he was wrong in a couple of things. And that was one of the things that, in 30 years, one of the 2 or 3 things that I might say he was wrong in. So that's a pretty good track record. So nothing to take away from him. But, and then, we kind of thought through it. And I had the privilege of working with Bert Glaser, who is truly a physician scientist. And he had this concept, well, maybe we can put some kind of additive in there. And he developed really this TGF-beta, which I don't know if there was a flurry of interest in that. And at the same time, people were using some blood clots and plasma, precipitates and platelet aggregates and things like that to just see if there could be some kind of biological glue. But all the while, Neil Kelly and Rob Wendell were, doing a poor man's approach, and they just kept getting better and better at doing macular holes. And we found out, even though we did a randomized trial and found the TGF-beta seemed to work phenomenally well, it worked almost as well to just simply do case selection and a careful drying at the hole and very fastidious face down positioning by the patient. And whether some of those things are important or not anymore, I don't know, but that's at least what was attributed by Kelly and Wendell is to having those great successes. And that kind of pretty much obviated any pharmacological approach. And we were doing that for probably most of the 90s or well into the 90s. And then the concept of peeling the internal limiting membrane came across. And that was, I'm going to attribute another sort of start, and this fits and starts kind of approach, was Logan Brooks. And he published a very landmark article where most of us were kind of beaten away with, 80% or something success with our macular hole surgery or something in that range. He presented a series of, 100 or 70 or something cases where after having peeled the internal limiting membrane, he had like a 95 or 99% success rate. So that really set everybody towards, oh, where do I get these forceps? How do you do them? And they were peeling internal limiting membrane. And then as the other people kind of gained experience, it's a little tricky to do that without any kind of staining, although you can usually do it, maybe not always. is there's the concept of stains, and then sort of chemo vitrectomy was born, or as a byproduct of that. And, you know, initially ICG, and then people use BBG, and you know, for truly vitreous, it's not really a stain, it's a vitreous suspension using, of course, the steroid. But so there's, you know, a series of events that occurred that really led to the whole thing. And, you know, you might look back at various times in history, and it's not like we went, you know, completely from a colony of Britain, shall we say, to our own, you know, republic. There was little events that happened, and sort of, you know, significant events, at least as history looks back. But at least I can say, having witnessed this, these were, you know, two or three different things that really happened that propelled macular hole surgery into what we think it is today. So now your question, though, was really, do we know more about what causes the holes to close? And of course, we could talk for hours about that. But, you know, it's interesting kind of to me that we've had another fit and start. And that is a lot of the seemingly good work really coming out of, you know, this ILM flap stuff is, you know, we always kind of thought, well, what we really need to do is free up any residual traction, as it were, or horizontal tractional forces around the edge of the macular hole so that can really lay down and be free to, you know, centripetally reapproximate. And maybe the gas bubble I've always envisioned is kind of the surface, the template for glial cells to grow across and bridge the gap in the hole and sort of cinch it down. Using the ILM to keep it there and or to have a free flap and put it there to act like maybe a super template. So, you know, I think that's, and then there's this technique of bringing a piece of retina and putting that in there. And, you know, we know that, you know, Grewal and Mahmood, you know, have done that. And again, they're presenting some impressive, even international series results at this point. So, you know, I don't think we want to lose the forest for the trees. I mean, does it do us any good to close the hole if the vision remains 2400, say? But again, this is one of those techniques that has been developed that, you know, will, some of which has already stood the test of time, and probably something else will come along to help that along the way also. But I think the frontier right now is not getting the hole closed. It's getting the hole closed with reproducibly better vision.
Right.
And that's still a frontier, I think, for these, so we just say difficult holes, these, you know, bigger holes and more, you know, or myopic holes that, you know, maybe have some physical forces because of the staphylomatous, you know, lie that they're on in the high myope.
Sure. You said so many things that were interesting there. And I love the story about Michael's and the idea of how we used to laser these holes flat, because the alternative in that situation would be leaving the retina detached with no vision. You would laser, you'd lose maybe a central scotoma, but you would attach the retina. And today you would just say, well, that would never be your primary option. That's a last resort, you know, breaking case of emergency option for a case like that. You do so many other things before you get to that point. So and that ties into my next thought, which is diabetes, right? So I have diabetic retinopathy. We're at an interesting juncture, I think, right? Because the panretinal laser was shown to reduce the progression and also the complications of proliferative diabetic retinopathy, right? And became the standard of care for high-risk proliferative diabetic retinopathy. And now we have these studies like Protocol S and Panorama for non-proliferative and Protocol W for non-proliferative that say, you know, we have anti-VEGF and anti-VEGF can work and it's less destructive and it doesn't affect the field. And on the one hand, I find, and I'm sure you feel the same thing, there's like three different things to think about. The one hand is the longevity of this therapy. And we can spend an hour talking about that. But you would assume that, if, let's say, things evolve and the therapy becomes more efficacious and lasts longer, then maybe that becomes less of an issue. The second is destruction, right? So it's always better to pick a less destructive treatment if all else is equal in terms of long-term effect and efficacy. But the last thing, which ties in a lot of the research you've done, is what about costs, right? We don't talk about costs a lot as individual retina doctors or physicians. Perhaps we shouldn't be having that conversation if we see the patient in front of us and have to make the decision that's best for their eye health, their vision. But inevitably, we're all contributing to that cost as a conglomerate of doctors, retina specialists, and ophthalmologists and physicians. And we all are in a society that ultimately there are limited resources in the world. And so the real question becomes, I'm curious what you think is going to happen. And this is, no one knows what's going to happen, but I'm just curious what you see as the tipping point here, where you have this efficacy versus maybe less destructive therapy versus also this cost issue that's hovering in the background. Where do you think we are? Do you think, like, for example, that we will be doing PRP in 20 or 25 years? just like we were just talking about the macular hole, that we wouldn't laser that as a first line therapy for a macular hole detachment today, PRP may not be first or second line in 15 or 20 years. Or do you think from a cost efficacy standpoint, you and others have published that PRP is actually very, very cost friendly compared to some of the options that are at least available today?
Yeah, well, there's a lot to unpack there, isn't there? And I'm going to try to keep your podcast from being divisive.
Sure.
Some of these things. But, well, you know, it's interesting to me as well that the PRP was something that was really an incredibly astute, and that was born out of an incredibly astute observation, as maybe you've talked about before, of a, you know, Lloyd Aiello, the senior Lloyd Aiello. And I know not junior and senior, but, you know, that's the way they're thought, where he looked at eyes that maybe were disproportionately having choroidal scars for some reason in diabetics, and they didn't develop the proliferative complications of the fellow eye that did not have those choroidal. So he surmised maybe we can make some scars, and you know, they began with that xenon photocoagulator to make marks, and we even used to talk about doing PRP in eyes that, I mean, cryo in eyes that we couldn't see because of blood, to you know, because we were more hesitant to do vitrectomy and things of that nature. So I think on the one hand, those were probably much more destructive days, as you were saying. Is it? I'm going to maybe ask what you said into a question. Is it more important to avoid destructing tissue than not destructing tissue? And I think it's important to preserve as much truly useful and productive tissue, not to say that the peripheral retina is not useful in its own sense, but you know, there's a lot of potential problems with the pharmacological approach, not only to proliferative, but even out to non-proliferative, you know, disease. And we'll end talking. I mean, I'll get to the cost issue in a bit, but you know, I mean, just the convenience issue. I mean, we saw during COVID so many people, and we continue. I think, I don't know about yourself, but I'm continuing to see people who I was seeing maybe once a year, and they just skipped their visit last year. But even earlier on, we put together a little series of some patients who did not come in during COVID, who were having ongoing macular degeneration or things that were dependent upon being maintained with intravitreal injections. And unfortunately, a number of them really didn't do so well, and we can't always reel them back in with more treatment. So I think what I'm trying to say is that we're almost getting people addicted to, you know, anti-VEGF or whatever other replaces it or, you know, augments it for that matter. So there's a certain danger in really shackling, if you will, that patient. They lose their insurance if they move, if they can't break into, you know, another routine, or if they just are too busy to get back in, or if they're, you know, whole plan changes. That there's a lot to be said for doing a PRP that doesn't have to be a George Blankenship style PRP. And I say that because I sort of inherited his practice, and in the day it was really a hyperpigmented, you know, arcade or even posterior to the arcade, all the way to the aura kind of situation. I think we can recognize that we can do, you know, a medium PRP that probably, if we redid some of those visual field or peripheral sensitivity studies, we would find that they're not nearly as debilitating as maybe the anti-VEGF aficionados would maybe want you to believe. So not to mention the fact that, you know, one in every 2 or 5,000 cases, there's going to be an endophthalmitis, which could be a completely devastating situation as well. But so what you were saying, though, is that we really have multiple options now, don't we? We can do a PRP, which is for the most part a one and done situation, which, you know, I'm a proponent of that for a variety of reasons. It just, you know, but or we can do the anti-VEGFs, or we did a little study that showed, you know, that an early vitrectomy is actually just as cost effective, if not more so, for PRP. Now, of course, we're usually doing some endolaser with the vitrectomy. So I think there's so many different aspects that are changing at the same time. I'd like to think, not naively, that we're with smaller incision vitrectomies, we can do them more safely now. We don't have the, you know, the expectation of anterior fibrovascular proliferation or, you know, incomplete removal of you know, some of the elements that maybe later come back to bite you in a vitrectomy. So, I mean, I would keep all three of those options open. So would we be doing laser in the future? Well, I sure do think so. At least in my lifetime, we will be. Who knows what's going to be going on in 20 years from now. But, you know, you kind of sometimes have to look back 20 years to maybe get a sense for what 20 years or 10 years or whatever it is might have to offer. But from a cost perspective, it's really essentially unsustainable. And I know that you're a better historian than I am, so I'm always trying and unsuccessfully to stump you. But I love this quotation by Calvin Coolidge, is that, you know, people can always spend other people's money more easily than they can spend their own. And I think right now we're really kind of struggling. And I've sometimes thought that, you know, as important as Medicare has been to enhancing the public health of our country, you know, which came through as part of the Great Society works with, you know, LBJ back in the late 60s, mid to late 60s, is that we've got this kind of somebody else is paying the bill kind of thing. And we don't really have any personal responsibility. Now, to a degree, I think sometimes we are a little bit now, whether there was capitated people, you know, people who are on plans for capitation purposes. I don't know how common that is. I don't think it's terribly common at the level of a retina specialist, but, or, you know, step therapy being imposed upon a variety of other things. So the insurance companies certainly do have their mind towards that. But then I guess Medicare is not part of really an insurance company, because it's really a third pool. And I think that we just need to be good stewards, because we as the doctors are really to some degree gatekeepers. But the problem is there's no real motivation. And I think, you know, I would hate to see fee for service go by the wayside, but I think irresponsible fee for service is what's is spelling its own disastrous end. So I don't know. I'm not calling for more governmental regulation as much as just really, I guess, more of a consensus. But it's hard to get a consensus when there's, you know, a broad spectrum of people's beliefs in that way. But it just would seem to me that it's unsustainable to continually broaden the indications for these $1,500 or $2,000 a dose injections that, okay, maybe they don't need to continually ad infinitum be every month, but, you know, it's much more expensive than doing a vitrectomy or certainly doing a laser procedure. And, you know, it also brings to mind, I think it was Madame Pompadour, Louis the 16th, who said, you know, after us, the deluge, or maybe that was actually Marie Antoinette, I'm not sure. But anyway, so, you know, there was a time at the late part, just prior to the French Revolution, where, you know, everyone was, well, you know, so what? The people are unhappy, but it's going to take them a while to get so unhappy that we lose our position here. So just go ahead and do what you want and let the next generation worry about it. But, you know, I don't, as a parent, I don't want the next generation to have to worry about it. And as a hopefully somebody who has some impact on the next generation of fellows, et cetera, I want you guys to be able, not you, you're not a fellow, but you know what I'm saying? I want them to be able to have a market, so to speak, to be able to practice proper medicine instead of really having their fists tied with, you know, doing $50 vitrectomies for all the trouble and hassle that might be involved, you know? And so I don't know the solution. If it was easy, somebody else would have figured it out certainly before me. But I think we're going down a dangerous path, a slippery slope, as the metaphor might have you to say, with all these extra injections. And it really worries me. Now, I'm going to be fine. I've got only a few years left in my career, so I don't, you know, I'm going to be okay. But I just hate to see that trend. And not to mention that there's, I think, to some degree, a little bit, I was quoting earlier that, you know, you just kind of have these default moves in the OR that I felt like I picked up from Ron Michaels. Well, you know, I hate for the default move to be, oh, okay, we'll just inject with more, you know, anti-VEGF and that'll work. And I think sometimes we miss the diagnosis, or we're having to continue to do injections because we're afraid that there'll be a bleed or something else will happen that will then be blamed at, because, oh, well, see, you were depriving me of those anti-VEGF agents that I, after all, worked all my life to pay into Medicare to cover, and, you know, and all those kinds of arguments. So there's, I guess a psychologist could have a heyday with some of our behaviors and how these things are working. But I just think we need to be very responsible about what we're doing. And we need to have sort of an adult in the room to really not be a consultant for the companies that are standing to benefit, you know, from doing this. And I'm a capitalist, so I'm not trying to call out the company. I think it's wonderful that, you know, these companies have developed these medications for us. They're powerful medications. It's, you know, macular degeneration has been completely revolutionized. I mentioned how Stuart Fine, when I was had gotten the macular photocoagulation study, I don't even know if people today know what the macular photocoagulation study is, because it was such a barbaric approach to treating, you know, choroidal neovascularization. And now there's no question but that you know, the work that's been done has completely revolutionized. And you know, we would have been delighted with a 2100 result after lasering these things. And now at 2100, we kind of hang our head in failure. So I mean, there's clearly a role for all this stuff, but you know, I guess it's the old saying as well that if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And you know, you really need to, I think it's important to define, and that's why we, I think, need to continue to do some of these studies. And I think a lot of these studies have to be kind of independent. And although it's important to verify a lot of these things with the large multi-trial trials, I think sometimes there's, you know, those trials can maybe be designed to answer a different question from what, you know, Mrs. Smith really needs to have done with her eye.
Right, right. Yeah, that's interesting. And I'm gonna pivot to the last question, which is a little more fun, but you've dropped multiple hints for the listeners who've been paying attention about your love for history via quotes and anecdotes and stories. So here is my two-part question. The first question, which you could talk about for a long time, I'm just curious. So why do you love history so much? And then the second question, which is more fun, is if you could have a table for four and have any three former presidents at the same table, and you could listen on the conversation, which three presidents would you want at that table to talk to each other?
Well, that's a cool question. That would be a hard one. But the first one, why do I like history? I think for one thing, I like to know things, you know, just even raw facts, true. But I think, and of course, everyone will say, well, history repeats itself. So if we can understand how certain problems were dealt with, whether they be medicine or American history or Roman history or what have you, I think there's certain principles we can probably recognize, because really people haven't changed, you know, in 2000, 5000, whatever years, they haven't changed. So for the most part, we're going to do the same things, maybe with different tools. But I think beyond it all, what I particularly love to read is, I think, you know, biographies, because I like to know what makes people tick. So I really like to try to understand, knowing that these icons, that, you know, dare I say they're statues now, but they were people too. And they kind of, they had foibles and they had things that they did wrong and things they could have done better. And, you know, and so there's no perfect man, shall we say.
Right, right.
And yet a lot of times it's not the victories that we really learn from, it's the defeats, right? Mm. There's a saying that goes, it's not how many times you fall down that defines your life and your career, it's how many times you get up, you know? And a lot of the people who have really accomplished something have met failures and met disappointments, and to understand what motivated them, why they did that. Was it their parents? Was it their schoolmaster? Was it their wife? Was it their husband? Well, you know, what was it that really made that person want to go on? And I, you know, sometimes I feel like almost like I could take personal, you know, I could go to school personally on that, as much as we want to know and recognize what our mistakes have been in the OR, what we could have done better in the OR or in the clinic or what have you, and learn from that. Now, you know, there'd be real risk in answering your second question in terms
of... I'll give you my answer, so it gives you some time to think. I mean, I thought, off the cuff, I would want Washington, Lincoln, and FDR, because I think it would be interesting to hear three sort of wartime leaders compare and contrast their experiences. Because you can argue about World War I in terms of the number of Americans involved, but you talk about the three most impactful wars that America has been in. I would argue those are probably the three most impactful between, you know, Revolutionary, Civil, and World War II. And I like military history. So I think it'd be interesting to see those three kind of compare and contrast. Obviously, the technology and things they had to deal with is very different, but sort of the whole idea of being there's a difference in being a wartime president, that big time, and that type of conflict, I think. It takes a special personality to kind of handle that. Just like there's better presidents for peacetime or prosperity and things like that.
Sure. Well, you know, the people who generally come to the top of the quote unquote best presidents list are the ones who have had to face some sort of adversity, such as a war. And maybe some people who just didn't have the fortune or misfortune of being a wartime president, they may have risen to the occasion, you know, and been famous in their own right. But I don't think your question really necessarily has to be answered as to who do I think are the three best presidents.
No.
As I said, I don't want to.
Who's going to make the best conversation?
I think the best conversation would be the shakers and the movers. So I'm going to maybe alienate some of your group by saying that, yes, I think Washington, he's my favorite president of all, because he initiated and started so many things and had such a unanimous you know, was held unanimously in such high regard.
No party.
You know, nobody ran against him in the first two presidential elections. He was the unanimous, you know, head of the constitutional convention. And, you know, yet having read him, there's some things, he was a human being as well. So I find it interesting to have him sitting at the table. And maybe I'm not quite as cerebral as you. So I think what I would choose as another person would be Teddy Roosevelt, because I think Teddy Roosevelt was really very innovative in his thinking and how he had approached things. He was a super shaker and a mover. And he was somebody who, you know, I got the impression you knew where you stood with him. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't going to kowtow to a political movement if he really believed this or that, you know, was right. I mean, you know, he was one of those rough and tumble type guys. And interestingly, he died at a relatively young age for being such all that. And there's a lot of interesting things about Teddy Roosevelt. And then the third person I'd want to sit at the table would be Donald Trump.
Oh, no.
I just think that we would get an unfiltered and I think more frequently accurate than the news would have you to believe view of certain things. But I think that I wouldn't get a word in. I wouldn't have a desire to get a word in edgewise about any of those three. They would have an unbelievable conversation that would talk about, you know, the formation, the growth, and the future of our country, really all in that group of three.
I worry that Washington doesn't get a word in at that table. Maybe not even at my table. He doesn't strike me as a particularly aggressive speaker, you know, like a Jefferson or someone who really would like take control of a conversation.
Well, you mentioned Abraham Lincoln, right? And he was the one who has that quotation of that he was at the, I think the state Senate at the time in Illinois. And he was at some discussion and one of his co-legislators said, "Hey, you didn't say anything about this." And he says, "Well, I'd rather be thought a fool than to speak up and remove all doubt." So
maybe he would be quiet too.
I think Teddy Roosevelt and Donald Trump actually do have a great respect for history and the founding of our country. Well, they did, you know, did and do respectively. And I think they would be very commonly turning around, and as much as they would be typically monopolizing a conversation, I think they'd want to know what Washington has to say about a thing at least as much as I do. Yeah. So I think he would be engaged. I don't think he'd dominate it, but I think he'd be asked fairly focused and pointed questions about things. And so I think he would get a word in, but he wouldn't be fighting to do it. I think he'd be invited to do it in a way that would, you know, be consistent with the honor that I think we should be according to him as, you know, basically giving his all for our country to get it started.
You know, it reminds me of my sister loves this quote. She always uses a Lincoln quote. He wrote a book review of some book, and I don't remember why he wrote this review, but the review was, "This is the sort of book you like if you like this sort of thing," which is actually a really brilliant quote for life, because we don't all like the same things. You know, there could be a best-selling history book that you and I would pick up and read. And just because it's a bestseller doesn't mean someone who doesn't like history would read it. Anyway, this has been a great conversation, Dr. Smitty. I've enjoyed catching up, learning, and hearing your thoughts. And hopefully the listeners did too. And thank you for taking the time.
Sure. Okay.
As always, you can find this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 302 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. In addition, you will find links to subscribe and receive email updates as episodes release. Those emails will go directly into your email inbox. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and you can contact us via social media or many other platforms. Our email is retinapodcast@gmail.com. And you can also reach out to us by clicking on the contact us link on our website. We love feedback on things we can do better and things you want us to continue doing. And again, I have many thank yous again for the listeners who listen. You deliver excellent patient care on a daily basis. You inspire the conversations you have here each week. And thank you for publishing and continuing to move the field forward. Thank you to Dr. William Smitty for his time. Thank you to Drs. Angela Chang, Louis Kai, and Mike Minacosta for everything they do for the podcast behind the scenes. And again, this is Jay Schreeder signing off.
feeling?
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.